I have to change the shirt though later. I found out that tonight's dinner will be tortellini, and I have vowed to never wear a white shirt with red sauce ever again.
Really? Tortellini? That's the bow tie, right? No, it's not.
It looks like an ear, almost. I mean, it looks like an ear if you are an MMA fighter or
cauliflower ear.
A wrestler. Yeah.
I think there's a lot of pasta that allows you to wear white or light colors without having to worry about red sauce, with the exception of spaghetti, mostly.
Yeah, linguine. It's like any long noodle that is going to do some like flicking around, or it's going to get wiggly and wet and wild. Like, you know, all good pasta experiences. It's normally not an issue, but I have had absolutely abysmal luck. Like, every time I wear a white shirt, I will, as daintily as possible, just like slowly and very like methodically eat the pasta. And then I will still find somehow that I've gotten a little spot of like red sauce on my shirt somewhere.
Do you have the same problem with ramen?
No, but I do have that problem with pho. If I have pho, there is a guarantee that I'm getting like some of the broth on me, no matter how carefully I eat it.
So what's the difference with that and ramen? I mean, like, not talking there about your be, bowl of ramen.
There should be no difference. There should be no difference at all. Just like I shouldn't have to worry about red sauce on a white shirt if I'm eating something that I'm just stabbing a fork into and then gently lifting towards my mouth with a napkin as an intermediary the whole way. And yet somehow, when the napkin is removed, there is red sauce underneath or something. I don't get it.
Well, so I was wondering if it was a matter of your technique, because the difference between pho, ramen...
Are you disparaging my technique?
No, I'm just saying that when you eat ramen and pho, generally speaking, you get it's into almost the bowl, thing. Right? Like,
yeah.
You lean in. I can't lean because of the microphone, but you lean over the bowl. You sink your head deeper in and you just start to, you know, slurp
up
those
you
noodles.
Dip your nose into the broth, because we do know that smell is the main factor for flavor, and so you're just submerging your face further and further into the broth until it just kind of soaks into your pores, and yet somehow it ends up on your shirt. No, and I don't know, it's literally the white shirt thing too, because I can almost guarantee I could wear a light different colored shirt, like non-white. We're saying I could wear like a light blue, where I would obviously still see a stain, not even a stain, but just like, I guess you can't call it a stain. We'll stick with stain, where I could see a stain right after eating the meal, but it won't be there because it's not a white shirt. Like, it's bad luck. It's a minor curse. I have upset some like very, very weak and nearly powerless like demon or spirit that has decided that this is the influence it can wreak havoc upon my life with. Can't do any more than that, but it's enough.
Nice.
Wait, did it really cut out for you guys?
I was with that. Yeah, it cut out for both of us.
Oh, I bet it's probably not loud enough then.
It's okay, because I know our intro so well that I got us to the intro ending anyway.
Well, it's episode 147 of Fancy Ramen Podcast on January 26th, 2020. I was about to say 2016.
Close. I'm Cookie.
Don't take us back.
I'm Neil.
And I'm Scott.
Today, I would like to move the notion of us discussing 2019, now that we have all assembled and it is no longer 2019.
We're running out of chances to discuss Game of the Year in any timely fashion. I am absolutely down.
Well, I'm glad that we took some time, because it allowed me to give a little extra time to commit to a few of these games that may or may not have topped my list.
No, it's good for me as well.
Silence.
Surprise, Cookie. Surprise.
It seems like now that we're not doing, or there's not really going to be much editing now, because I'm working pretty crazy hours on top of trying to be a little more active on my stream. It's funny that we have even more vocal pauses after I've committed to this resolution.
Hey man, those New Year's resolutions, they count for something.
it's almost better to like make the resolution in the opposite direction of what you want things to go in.
That's true. I will edit even more. No, that would be very, very bad. So, I mean, are we all in agreement that this is going to be our 2020 celebration, 2019 celebration?
Why not?
Yeah, I think so. I think the only other thing to consider on the docket is if Cookie has anything that's big PAX related that's worth bringing up as opposed to feeding in later. He was on assignment. I don't want his trip to have been for naught.
That is true.
So I guess there are like two things that are video game PAX related. This PAX seemed a little smaller, like a little less like PAX full of like AAA games and things. Mm-hmm. But there's a game coming out. Oh, can you see it? Called Speaking Simulator.
On Switch and PC, January 30th.
I'm pretty sure I've seen this before. It's where you actually use your keyboard and mouse to control your lips and tongue and so forth, right?
Yes. And my God, it is just a... It was just a riot for like the 15-minute demo I got where I was flirting with some lady. It gives you like the prompts of what you're going to say. Mm-hmm. You then have to control your tongue, lips, and jaw to make those word shapes.
So we're getting a quap with your mouth?
Yes. And it is just as awkward. Because, like, if you move your tongue a little bit too far out or a little bit too fast, since you are a robot
mm-hmm.
that is trying to pass as human, you will knock your teeth out, which are really just like, you know, the micro SD cards?
Yeah.
It's literally just like micro SD cards, white micro SD cards as your teeth, because you can see the yellow stripped connection points.
Oh, that's funny.
You're sure that's not just delicate plaque buildup and coffee staining?
I wish. But yeah. And then the other really interesting thing that I saw was a company called Rainway, R-A-I-N-W-A-Y. They are a streaming company in the sense of Xbox... What's the Xbox streaming thing that they're doing now? And blah, words.
Mixer?
Nah, they're a streaming company where you can stream your PC to your mobile devices, basically.
Oh, okay.
And so I was testing it out the other day, like on Wednesday at work, because I usually don't leave my computer on, but for Wednesday I left a computer on, and I was playing Forza Horizon 3 on over LTE with, I'll be honest, it was a lot of lag, but it was still like enjoyable in the sense of like, oh, this tech actually works. So if I throw something on, like, I almost said FTL, but that's going to be a little bit too, I need that precision timing. If I throw on like a real-time strategy game where timing is not of the essence, so turn-based combat.
A factor, yeah.
Less real-time, more turn-based.
Yes. What'd I say? Shush. But yeah,
portable JRPGs. You're telling me that the Vita isn't dead?
Pretty much. But so it was an interesting little tech demo that I got to... I guess it's not really a tech demo since it's out and usable. It's in beta right now for the Android devices and officially available for iPhones and whatnot, iOS mm-hmm. devices, and it's free.
Okay, real so question like, here. Does it perform better than remote desktop control? Like if you were to use one PC and go to another, I realize it's a mobile device instead, but
mm-hmm.
Does it have worse latency than that?
It's about the same from what I remember, but the last time I used a remote desktop control was like years ago. But I'll say the setup's a lot easier because you literally are connecting through the Rainway servers.
I'll be honest, I'm kind of surprised that this isn't something that already exists because Like, granted, this isn't always a good barometer, but Apple's had a solution to this for quite a while. Granted, it's not over LTE or Wi-Fi, or excuse me, cellular data, but instead through Wi-Fi, you can hook up like an iPad to mirror any Mac.
Yeah. And but don't they have to be on the same
network?
Yes. Network.
I believe they have to have some sort of commonality when it comes to that. Like, you can do some pretty ridiculous stuff across like a wide network. And when I say wide, I don't just mean like wide area network WAN, but like a wide network. We used to do it in college as a way to get around having to be in the control room to do something like starting a recording, so we could be in the live room and stuff, or even be like in the other half of the building adjusting something at the control room. So it's pretty impressive. At the time, like 2014 or 12.
So it's basically that, just on a grander-ish scale. Like, Rainway will scan your computer and say, okay, you have these games. We're going to make like a quick launch thing of all your video games that you have. But you can also just minimize the screen, the Rainway screen, and then you just got full access to your desktop. But it does give you that quick launcher.
Quick aside, but did I tell you guys I ended up getting like a Steam Link?
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
No, we didn't hear that.
For dollars when they were essentially clearancing out the hardware. And I played Sekiro on it. Now, granted, this was, again, one network, but it's kind of like having that same front-end style thing. And like, as convenient as it is, I do kind of hate having to be shackled by the front end, but I realize that's a much more customer appealing, or like it's something that appeals to like the non-pro user, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all about that ease of use, and that's one reason I like Rainway. It makes me just feel like I'm doing the PlayStation Remote Play, which you can also access over separate networks.
Another quick aside that's tangential. Have you ever tried to use Parsec before?
I have not used Parsec.
It's a screen sharing app. Not really screen sharing. It's sort of like, I'm trying to like dumb it down, but basically it's a program that allows you to bypass the netcode of any game and play essentially local co-op or couch co-op or whatever, or versus with someone else at a PC, you know, however far away. So I could play Street Fighter V with you on Parsec.
Nice.
And you wouldn't need to own the game.
Using Parsec, a user can stream video game footage through an internet connection, allowing one to run a game on PC but play it remotely. Parsec can also be used as a low latency desktop sharing software. That is according to Wikipedia.
I'm really curious as to whether or not a company like that would ever be interested in taking that net code and then porting it to a phone or mobile device, because I feel like as much of a market as there is for that type of solution, it almost makes more sense to me if one of these guys that is, or one of these companies that have really like nailed it down in one form can then take that work and distribute it to other platforms. But granted, cellular data is probably going to be a completely different game than across, you know,
secure Wi-Fi connections or secure network connections.
Exactly.
But those are kind of like my big two things from PAX this year. Did get to play, like, Axe Cop is getting a new video game.
It had one before?
I don't think so.
Just to make sure, Axe Cop, it's the comic slash maybe now cartoon where the creation of the character and idea was that an older brother was animating the ideas of his younger brother, and the younger brother came up with the idea of the Axe Cop. And we're talking like he was probably like 6 or 7 at the time of the creation of Axe Cop.
He was 5.
5, okay, yeah.
Yeah, he was 5 at the creation of Axe Cop, and the older brother who was doing all the animation and comic book drawing wasn't changing like anything story-wise. He was just bringing his 5-year-old brother's ideas to life. But yeah, so no, Axe Cop is it was an interesting game. It was a 16-bit style turn-based combat, think like Final Fantasy 3/6.
Oh,
but then
really?
It had like weird platforming things, so think the Messenger.
Would it be close to compare it to Indivisible?
I have no idea what Indivisible is.
It's a Valkyrie profile style game in terms of combat that has platforming elements. We don't have to get into it.
But it was a pretty interesting thing. Pretty interesting game that I got to play.
Do you know what the full name of it is?
Axe Cop. Presented by Red Triangle Games. So Red Triangle Games is developing it. But it's literally just Axe Cop the RPG.
That's kind of cool.
I was playing a Christmas themed level. So I was at the North Pole, and at one point I got knocked off of a cliff, and then I was playing you remember that old skiing game on the old Windows computers where if you were skiing for too long you get attacked by the Yeti?
Yeah.
I was pretty much playing that, but instead Axe Cop was surfing on his axe while being chased by an avalanche. And then it turned into like just a normal JRPG after that within the same level. It's super weird. They got full permission from the creators and everything to like do a loving recreation of the Axe Cop universe. They seem very excited about it. And I will also say, if you're not into sports games and if you're not into fighting games, Windjammers 2 is probably not the game for you. But Windjammers is now something I'm really excited to play in the future.
Have you played the original before?
Never played the original, like right before PAX. I ended up watching a documentary on Windjammers 2 and was like, oh, this is weird. And as we get onto the PAX show floor, there's a game called Shoot 1, or Shot 1, Shotone. They were actually developing their Windjammers clone at the same time as the guys who were developing Windjammers 2. And they both teams tried to get the actual like license, the official license for Windjammers. One obviously got it, one did not. After playing both Shot 1 and Windjammers 2, I enjoyed Windjammers 2 more. My brother enjoyed Shot 1 more. Only problem is, though, is that Shot 1 doesn't have a publisher, and they never know when they're going to come out, whereas Windjammers 2 will be out soonish. I forget what the exact release date is. But that was my PAX corner for this year. Didn't really go behind the scenes and do any kind of like interviews or anything this year. I decided to just play it cool.
We had talked about like getting you a recorder, and then you just, which again, I would rather you just enjoy the show. It's not like we have a real media presence. Then you just suddenly were gone, and I think Scott and I were both just like, what?
Yep.
He already left. It also occurred to me that your phone probably records better than any handheld recorder at this point, unless you're getting some specialized one from Sony.
Nah, yeah. And that's what I also thought too, and thought to myself, okay, if I see something that I really, really am interested in, then I'll definitely record something.
Yeah, if you run into Uchikoshi Kotaro, the creator of I, the Somnium Files, then like that would be, I would have expected you to do an interview with him on the spot.
Oh, yeah, of course, because I would have been like, oh, yeah, my friends really love this game. Oh, I guess I should say I did get the most weeb game that I could possibly get, because on the last day of PAX, I was like, you know what? I want to get a board game, but I really want to let my otaku flag fly. So I got a game called Love Battle High School. It is a harem anime-style board game where you control both the protagonist and the five girls vying for the protagonist's attention or affection. So at the beginning of the game, you and whoever you're playing with choose up to one to two waifus. You can either go for, I just want to choose the best girl, or I want to try and do a love triangle by the end of this game.
And so you're playing as, what's the competition element on it?
So each girl has their own unique deck that gives them things that they can do. They can make, I think it's like, if each deck has 3 to 4 different actions, you've got the flirting action, which gives you love and negatives love for anyone in the same room as you. Mm-hmm. The seduction action, which gives you love, but no one can be in the same room but you and the protagonist. Mm-hmm. The jealousy action is can be played if someone does like a flirting action while you're in, while your girl is in the room, and then she could be like, "Oh, how dare you do that, Baka?" And then that girl gets negative love instead of positive love, and it's pretty much each player is controlling all the girls. Mm-hmm. It goes through seven rounds, which is a Japanese school day, so seven periods, including lunch.
Mm.
And there are outside factors that will play a role into each of the periods, starting in the second period. So think, what was that one anime, Love is War?
Yes, Kaguya-sama, Love is War.
Yeah,
so good.
So think that with like the third party elements of that anime, but you're basically just choosing your best girl and manipulating the school day in such a way that your girl is getting all the love and affection. So that way, whoever's got the most love gets to go on the date at the end of the day.
How do you line up being in the same rooms?
So the rounds go two phases, hero phase and girl phase. You can do either phase first.
Mm-hmm.
The hero phase is the hero can move two spaces and he can do one of three things. He can draw a girl card. He can draw a girl card or activate the classroom special ability. So the girls' locker room special ability is just a peek.
Oh no.
The janitor's room, which came into like the janitor's closet, which came in super handy for like a two-player game, allows you to pull one girl into the janitor's closet. Then you get to roll a dice, and depending on what the dice roll is, a couple of things happen. Either something is neat as, what are you two doing in here? So another girl comes into the room, and that girl that you pulled into the room gets negative love, and all the way up to, I have something to tell you, where you confess your love and the girl gets like a super huge boost of love.
Mm.
And then the girl's phase is you get to draw a card for the girl, move her up to as many spaces as you have cards by just discarding cards, and then you can play any card that you want as long as you're in the same room as the protagonist. And the five girls range from the tsundere character who does things for you, but it's not because she likes you. You've got your childhood friend character, the most popular girl in school, aka the student council president. You've got the girl that will give you pleasure, but not in a way that you expect. So she's the BDSM character. Then you got your loli character as well.
Just to make sure, the overall scope of the game is that the players are picking their girl/girls, and there's only one guy who is the object of their affection, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
He's just your normal high school student, just trying to get through his senior year of high school, until suddenly these five girls start vying for his attention.
Shaggy
hair. What is
hair,
he gonna do?
Shaggy dark hair, probably doesn't have any eyes visible.
He does have eyes visible.
Oh,
he does
surprising.
He does have shaggy brown hair, but his school uniform is quite literally a white button-up t-shirt with a green jacket and khaki pants. So generic looking as fuck. Ah, it's wonderful. And it's okay, because I wanted something super weeb, and I went out of my way to find the most weeb thing I could. And as I'm like trying to get a demo to play this game, I end up talking to this one dude who's like working at the booth. And I was like, oh yeah, so yada, yada, yada. How is this? What do you think of this game? And he's like, he starts telling me all about it. And then all of a sudden and I was like, yeah, okay, I think I will get it. He's like, sweet. If you get it, I'll definitely autograph it for you. By the way, I'm the creator. And I was like,
oh, that's cool.
Sweet. So I've got a signed copy.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
The actual creator of the game. And then I started doing like, so since we didn't actually get a demo on the show floor, he described it to us. And I was like, this seems easy enough. By the time we got back to the hotel that night, we popped it open, played, and it is a blast. it's definitely a weird, unique, interesting concept of a game that is just, that's just lovely. It just fills that weeb trash in you, just like, oh man, I just really want to watch a stupid anime that's got no meaning to it at all. Let's do this.
But I want to be competitive about it too.
Exactly. So yeah, so Love Battle High School, I give it a 5 out of 5. It is pretty much a perfect game from the one time I've played it, even though I was slightly inebriated, but just talking to the creator and even saying to the creator before I knew he was a creator, he was the creator of the game. It's like, yeah, I'm just really looking for something that's like a weeb trash game. And this really caught my eye. He didn't say anything, but he had a knowing smile.
Look no further. Yeah.
Because he knows what he did. Mm-hmm. But it was a great game. But that was my PAX corner for our 2020 Game of the Year edition of Fancy Ramen Podcast.
2019.
Where was this year's PAX at? I don't know anything about PAX.
Oh, no. PAX South is held every year in San Antonio.
Wow, would have guessed wrong. I was going to say Austin.
Unfortunately not. You definitely would have guessed wrong.
San Antonio's the cool town.
It was not cool. It was warm and it was lovely.
It's technically cooler than all the other Texas towns though, because they have the river running through.
They do have the river running through. And that's fine, because I'll let you know, we were wearing shorts in January.
That's nice.
I'm wearing shorts as my wife is like, I don't know how to use the snowblower. And it's snowing and raining and snowing in Nebraska. And I was like, yeah, good luck. Good luck. But yeah, no, this year, just did PAX South again. Just had a, met some of Lizzie's friends last night, and apparently they go to PAX Prime every year. So I might be doing that.
Where's that at?
Seattle.
Oh, okay. That's the one that I can get to.
So, and they, the people that we met, they've got family there. Mm. So that would actually like distribute some of that cost of PAX Prime, because right, it's the one of the most expensive places to visit for a PAX convention.
So is PAX Prime when PAX gets the AllSpark, the Transformers mm-hmm. AllSpark, and inserts into itself?
Quite literally, it's the big PAX.
Yeah.
Besides PAX Australia.
when is it?
It is Labor Day weekend.
Yeah. Mm.
At some point, so want to like go out to a convention like that, but it's just, this isn't necessarily a good year.
I was going to say, you just got to pull the trigger. Like last year, it was quite literally, I was like, you know what? Screw it. I'm done just talking about some point I want to go. And I was just like, I'm going. Are you coming with me? To my brother and some of my friends. And my brother was like, yes. And some of my friends were like, yes.
How much did this trip cost you, if you don't mind me asking? Ballpark. You don't have to give me the...
I want it down to the cents. I need to budget this properly.
Also, if you paid for gas, I'm going to need the fraction of the cents as well.
And the gas station set you stopped at.
Yeah.
So my brother actually drove down this year. He ended up spending around $175 for gas going to and from, and he drove from Iowa to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say my plane ticket was like maybe $300.
That's pretty good.
We found like a bombastic deal.
Frontier? Southwest?
Southwest. So plane ticket, we'll say $300. Maybe spent, because we did a couple of fancy dinners, maybe spent like $300 on food. And then I bought some nice dice. So about $100 on dice.
Oh my God.
I bought 2 sets though. And then the board game was like $40. So maybe like $600, $700, $800. I could have easily spent over that because, oh my God, guys, I saw the set of dice. They were tungsten and they felt so nice. Like they felt so good. I wanted to vomit as the lady put them in my hand. They were $300.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got reprimanded literally yesterday for like, why do you need more dice? You have plenty of dice. I'm like, I want more though.
I want
you can't really
dice.
Stop. Yeah, like once you get good dice, you're like, well, I could have more good dice. I don't have this color combo yet, and since there's literally an infinite number of color combos, you can never stop.
I feel like this is one of those few times where I'm actually on the outside of the nerddom conversation, because I'm thinking to myself, you know what would be great? A random number generator that I could just have on my phone. Oh, wait. I'm sure there's an app for it, and you can just put whatever your dice configuration you need for it.
But you can't throw your phone to make the app work, and that's
They actually do have apps that you shake your phone to make the dice rolls.
Still not as good.
You don't have to throw it, but yeah.
It's not nearly as good. And let me tell you guys, the D20, it was like 2.5 pounds.
Oh.
It felt so good. I felt like Kirito in all of his sword art animes where he's like, oh man, I need a heavy sword. This sword's not heavy enough. I need it heavier. I just need the heaviest dice I could possibly get.
All right. I hate to do this, but...
Look at the time.
No slow, awkward fade out there. Just a really abrupt one.
Oh, okay. 2019. I was like, did it cut again? I don't want to interrupt.
2019. What are your games of the year? These are personal lists. I don't know if you guys want to... Everyone has listed a top three. I don't care if you guys want to mention more than that. But I figure if there are any games that we share in our lists, we can talk about them at the same time.
Should we start with those then?
I don't know. I'd say we start from number three and up if you have a particular order. In Cookie's case, it sounds like there is not. A particular order.
There's no particular order. Yeah. It's like, what games did I play this year? Oh, that game came out? Nice. I played a shit ton of that.
We should do an ascending order from the docket then. So, Cookie, you can start and pick from your no particular order.
Or we could do... No particular order.
We could also do the honorable mentions really quickly.
Okay, we'll do the honorable mentions really quickly. In no particular order, my honorable mention... was Call of Duty Modern Warfare. It strived to be different and go back in time and be the same, and it was just what everyone wanted it to be. It's a solid Modern Warfare. It's a solid Call of Duty game. Lizzie literally texted me the other day. She's like, you know what, I miss playing Call of Duty. And I was like, me too. We haven't played in a while. We should definitely get on that. Oh, and I guess since I discovered it in 2019, Sea of Thieves. Because that game's just the tops.
The top sales.
Eggs, yeah.
Okay. My honorable mention that didn't make it into my top was the Resident Evil 2 Biohazard remake. I thought that was one of my favorite Resident Evil games that I've played. If they remake Resident Evil 4, I really want to like kind of do a side-by-side comparison because I don't know what I like better now. My memory of 4 is too old for me to be able to like really rely on it without nostalgia. But being trapped in sort of a house maze the whole time or most of the game, and the like option to take essentially, or the option to have like a route A or a route B, depending on which character you choose and what weapons and equipment you interact with, was really cool, and the replayability was great. That was one of the few games that I've played the first, the first completion, and then immediately finished the second completion without any delay or deviating to like another game. Just lots of fun. And Mr. X Gonna Give It To You is possibly the best environmental threat of the year. I don't think there was a single game that inspired more fear than like the sound of big boots stomping on creaky floorboards somewhere nearby, but who knows exactly where.
That definitely was one of my honorable mentions. It's kind of funny because I feel that if a few other games hadn't come out, it would have absolutely been in my top three. It's a really fun game, and it's like the perfect degree of scariness. I can't play a lot of scary games or horror games and so forth. But Resident Evil 2 was just perfect. Like, it got me to the point where I was definitely having like real world anxiety dealing with Mr. X, but not so much in a way that Jack almost made me feel like I couldn't play Resident Evil 7.
Okay.
Granted.
I mean, I get it. There was at least one time in Resident Evil 2 where I was like, I'm going to stop playing right now, not because it's too late or not because I have something else to do, but I'm just a little too disturbed to move forward right now.
The thing with the Tyrant in Resident Evil 2 is that it's more predictable, and you kind of know what you're expecting out of it. But I mean, really, the biggest twist for me, which granted it relies on having played the past game, but it was even seeing Mr. X to begin with, because you would not encounter the Tyrant or Mr. X, however you'd prefer to name him, in your first playthrough of Resident Evil 2. So when Tiff and I played the game, and the expectation was that I was going to play the first playthrough as Leon, and she was going to play Claire in the B route, which, by the way, she got shafted pretty hard for that.
Wait, why is that? Just because the Claire route was
Claire's
less fun,
B route or? Is just like more difficult. Her weapons to begin with are just harder or like worse, mm-hmm. I think. And then the other thing is that her, we'll say secondary pistol, because essentially in the B route, your main pistol, you don't get that much ammo for. So the secondary pistol more or less becomes your primary, you know, deal with it firearm. The one that, like, if you just need to pop people in the kneecap or if you have to try and get some headshots, et cetera, that's your weapon. Hers is a six or five, I don't remember now.
It's either a five shooter, if I remember correctly.
But so her B route weapon is like a six load revolver, and you can only load the rounds one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh wait, no, it's both of them that have. Oh man, I might be forgetting this.
No, Leon in the B route. Not to spend too much time on it, I'm pretty sure he gets that like 45 ACP or whatever.
Oh yeah, that makes sense. I remember now.
Which is great. Honestly, it's a great B route weapon.
He just has the gangster stance to it, right? Which is kind of stupid, but whatever.
I don't remember exactly. I just know that it's a little bit more powerful than the 9mm.
And he holds it to the side, which is like, why would he do that? It's still a pistol, but whatever. Anyways, so when I was playing through the A route, I just remember thinking like, I get to bypass the Tyrant.
And then he throws a helicopter out of the way, and you scream like a little girl. Yeah.
Yep. That game was absolutely a lot of fun too. I had, again, as someone that doesn't necessarily always prize gameplay as being the most important factor for me, when a game is absolutely that much fun to play, it's a testament to like the mechanics of the game. Like, sure, some things are cumbersome, but Resident Evil 2 is absolutely a must play just for the sheer fun of it. All the additional DLC and stuff on it were just more reasons for you to play the game and have fun. Very, very good release.
Also, Overnob is back with us, and he says yes to the X, but he prefers the name Mr. Y. Welcome back.
If we're assigning a gender to Mr. X, he would have a Y.
Yeah, he would have a Y. Take notes, Capcom.
Another honorable mention that might be notable. Actually, never mind. This is your two, so I'll hold off on that. Cookie, why don't you go through your games?
Yeah, so in no particular order, since my games don't overlap with your guys' games, my bad. but in no particular order, my top three games that I really enjoyed the most this year are going to be three games I oddly finished, which is speaking loads for me.
I mean, that is an endorsement in its own right.
I've got Kingdom Hearts 3, which just came out with the which is just coming out with the Remind DLC, which I'm going to enjoy.
Is that the hey, just to remind you, we exist?
This game existed, and apparently there's going to be a couple of different bosses. They've also included dual wielding back, and the keyblades for Oblivion and Oathkeeper are back in it now, but you don't have to buy the DLC to own those, so yay. We've got Katana Zero, which thank you guys for speaking on that and turning me on to that, because that story just money for that story.
I mean, and so far there seems to be a theme on your list with incomprehensible stories. So,
yeah. Yeah. And I do like the gameplay of Katana Zero. I was a really big fan of both Hotline Miami and Hotline Miami 2. So that whole frantic one shot, you're dead type of gameplay really, really speaks to my soul.
Yeah.
And then the final one on my list is Borderlands 3, which you could also say also has kind of an incomprehensible story. But I enjoyed the fact that it returned to form of the looter shooter, and it was something I didn't get tired of because it didn't have that grindy aspect of what looter shooters became when it comes down to the when it came to Destiny's and, oh god, what was that other looter shooter that came out after
Apex Destiny? Legends.
Nah, that was more of a, whatcha call it?
A flop?
What is going on in my chat? but yeah, so those are going to be like my top three games of the year that I could remember off the top of my head.
I mean,
a couple of weeks ago.
I'm glad Katana Zero made your list, because I had a lot of fun with that game. And I was really glad that when you and Neil played it, you guys agreed on that. It's nice to see indie games get some love, since they almost didn't make any of our lists.
I kind of feel bad for leaving them out, but
it's tough sometimes. Indie games, like, they are fighting an uphill battle in a lot of ways. Sorry, I had to leave that really big, long pause for the fact that we're not editing anymore.
I'm making up adult hentai game names in chat right now, so I've got
Okay.
That is literally what is going on in my chat.
Okay.
The number one hentai survival island.
Wait. That's actually the truth, by the way. It's because indie developers are now making hentai games instead. Like, there's not enough talent in the non-pornographic game industry to support the indie industry.
Got to follow the money.
Hentai Survival Island is a real game. That's a real game? Is that a real game?
Why don't you Google it for us?
I am.
Hopefully you don't have it on on stream.
Why don't you also do it on what is it? I can't remember even what they call that mode anymore. Whatever the private browsing, that's what it is.
That is incognito. Is a real game.
Shows how sneaky I can be.
It is a real game. Developed by CGGT Group and published by them. It's available in the Windows Store in Overdub. He's a fan. He says it's money.
Okay.
It's 69 cents on Steam right now.
Of course.
Ooh, 30% off? Really? Nice.
I hate to break it to you guys, but this is a May 2nd, 2019 release, so it does qualify.
Oh, God, 69 cents.
Oh, man. It's, I think there's Minecraft elements to this.
It is a survival game. All right. I know what we're going to be streaming Streaming next week, boys.
Scott, you have a few items on your list that I'll speak on as well.
Why don't you go first? Yeah.
Really? Okay.
No, so, I mean, talk about my list first before I talk about my list.
You wanted to play the Outer Wilds. I don't know why you didn't, because...
I heard nothing but, like, amazing praise for it. Same. And then I just keep forgetting. It's almost the same thing as the Obra Dinn, too, though, where I'm like, I want to solve a mystery, but I'll do that later. And then I just didn't get to it yet.
Maybe I could stream Obra Dinn. Obra Dinn.
Oh, I would absolutely watch
it. Have you played that yet?
Mm-mm.
No.
Oh, it's great.
I tend to, I think, prioritize characters more, and so it kind of keeps falling off my list, the short list of games to play.
It's wonderful on Switch, I'll just say, because you kind of just take it with you. You spend 5 to 10 minutes puzzling over a weird looking death, since it's one bit, and you either figure something out or not, and then you just come back to it later. I enjoy that gameplay. But anyway, guess.
Scott, on your third favorite game of 2019, you have Disco Elysium, a game that I would say also deserves an honorable mention for me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I really do think, like, even though we definitely found some, like, rough edges with the game, it was one of the most unique and interesting and fun experiences I had this year when it comes to video gaming. It was the type of game that I don't usually play. It had a surprisingly infectious soundtrack for maybe like 5 songs or something, or like five, yeah, maybe 5 songs tops. I don't even know if there was that much. And it was walls and walls of dialogue and text, and I liked reading every single bit of it. Like, there was almost never a time where I was like, okay, shut up, let's roll through this. Like, I enjoyed having probably, I don't know, like a 20-minute long dialogue tree with a character.
So,
because
question,
there was so much to do and say and learn. Go ahead.
Before you get any further, for our listeners and the people watching this live, what's the name of the game that you guys are talking about?
We're talking about Disco Elysium.
We had said it before, too. Just
yeah, you did? Okay.
Yep, it's produced or developed by ZAUN, I believe. Let me double check that. Yeah, ZA/UM.
I would want to note, too, that like the fact that we can criticize it so definitively
is because we spent so much time with it.
Well, but also because I think it's worth criticizing. And that I think is a compliment, too. It's, again, I don't necessarily feel I enjoyed it as much as you, but I would not have given it any sort of critical thought had I not appreciated what the game was attempting to do or what the game succeeded at doing, too.
Right. I mean, I'm just happy that I found the Phasmid, let's be honest here.
or the cryptid?
The cryptid, yeah. The Insulidian Phasmid, which is a cryptid.
Okay. I mean, that goes to show you, I skipped a lot of dialogue at some points.
Okay.
I just was like, I don't
completely
care what you
undermining
have to
what
say.
I had to say.
Click, click, click.
Excellent game. There's not a huge amount to say about it, I think, at this point. But because we are doing Game of the Year, the basic overview for the game is you play an amnesiac detective who, along with his sidekick Kim Kitsuragi, scour the Martinez district of a, like, once great, I guess, civilizations, like center of civilization. You could say empire, you could say kingdom. Like, it is such a messy place where so many things have happened. It's actually hard to describe because the history is so dense. And part of the job of you trying to solve this murder case is your detective either purposefully or accidentally, like, stumbling deeper and deeper into all of the inner workings of this location and its people, and uncovering just, like, super weird mysteries and truths that you only scratch the surface of for, what,
feels like hours and hours, and then you find yourself completely in over your head on. It's a delightful game. Like, there's not much in the realm of, like, role-playing games that is beyond what's being offered by Disco Elysium here. You can kind of shape and mold your character any way you'd like. And the thing that I find most interesting about how the game approaches it is, instead of you selecting, this is what my character is going to be like in menus before the game, and then make decisions that kind of work with that because it's numerically advantageous, or it works with the premise you have of the character at the start. This character can honestly be like reshaped and molded by how you interact with the world in ways that you don't expect or aren't necessarily intending on doing. Your character is sculpted more by action and response than it is by initial intention. And I think that is a really cool principle in game design. Thank
well
you.
Said.
We also share another title. It's your second top.
And it's only an honorable mention for you. And that
didn't
is...
didn't even make it to my honorable mentions.
Fire Emblem Three Houses, a game that I did not expect to hit the top of my list until I was building the list. And I thought, what other game did I put more than 100 hours into and only stopped playing because there were other games I needed to play for the podcast and felt guilty that I was still playing like the third story route of this game.
Wait, so you didn't get through all 17 stories?
I have two story routes left to complete. I'm halfway through the church route, and I did not touch the Boar Prince's route.
Well, I'm going to let you know that they're coming out with some DLC and there's going to be a secret fourth house.
We've talked about it.
We have talked about that.
God, I really should listen to our podcast sometimes.
It's okay. That's what our fawning listeners are for. They do the real heavy lifting, and that is sitting down with our voices for more than an hour.
Fire Emblem Three Houses, I think, was a nice reminder to the world that a specific genre still exists. And I think it did more than enough. We might have talked about this to some extent with the Smash announcement of Byleth. But it was very surprising and absolutely worth note that people that had never played a Fire Emblem game were drawn to this. And obviously the game was extremely hyped by, you know, fans of the original series and so forth. And so much, too, that I feel like it was such a change to the formula that Fire Emblem has kind of followed throughout the last 20 years, I'd say, maybe, at this point. I really, really commend the willingness to go out on a limb and do something completely different from what they could otherwise have done, which is a very smart and boring sequel. Not to say the past games are boring by any stretch of the imagination, but it's not like they always are, you know, have the innovation.
Yeah, there's a pretty big swing in story quality, I think, for some of the Fire Emblem games.
That is very true. Three Houses might not have made my list particularly because I feel like it felt that there were certain story elements that were either rushed or just never hit full fruition. I mean, but I can say the same thing about Persona 5.
Wait, was that 2019?
No, that was 2016-17, depending on your region.
Oh, okay.
God, if I got to play Persona 5 for the first time again, I would have been hyped.
Yeah, I think there are a few games that... There are a couple games out there in the world that it's almost sad that you can't play them for the first time again.
Like Pepsi Man.
The last game that I have on my list is... my absolute favorite, and I think like a completely uncontested game for the top spot since it came out. I just didn't bump into anything that could shake how good my experience with it was, and that was Sekiro: Shadows Die Twice. I mean, loyal listeners of the podcast will know that it was probably an easy decision for me, and I kind of had the expectation or suspicion it would end up on Neil's list as well, because we are such big fans of the Dark Souls, Bloodborne, From Software background of games. And it just, like, it checked every single box that I wanted. And it did some things I did not expect from a From Software game at all. Like, Sekiro is the first game to, I think, prevent you from just, like, falling off of the map with not always, like, you're not completely boxed in to avoiding falling from a high space, but because of the verticality of the game, this was the first time that I, like, felt safe or comfortable walking across a branch and not immediately, like, slipping to my death. I mean, that's actually that's a huge game design change for them, is to create a more, I'd say, like, a little bit more rigid or concrete map and world design than they had with their previous games. And it really worked well with the, it really worked well with the background of it being a much more action-oriented game.
So that's what brought your Sekiro to the top of your list, huh?
No, it's not. But it was just such a weird thing. I had to mention it before I forgot. I mean, the reason Sekiro is such a good game, and the reason that it is my favorite game and the top of my list over anyone else's, is because there's nothing I like more than a really big challenge that I am eventually able to overcome, whether it is on the first try or if we're talking about that goddamn Guardian Ape, like, the 40th try. These games really, like, push our limits in ability and grit, especially a game like Sekiro, where there's no such thing as grinding for being able to do higher damage, and there's no grinding for getting a bigger health bar. There's no way to pad stats to make up for your lack of, like, competency or ability to play the game. And being forced into an even more, like, inflexible mode of difficulty, I think, creates a better and more curated experience with the game. I get that it is a barrier, and it will turn a lot of people off to playing these types of games. So I harbor no ill will. I have no critique for anyone who is just like, that game was too hard, I couldn't play it. I get it, and I understand. There are games that I play that are too hard for me to, like, continue on. And they even sometimes have, like, mutable difficulty, and I still, like, on super easy with certain types of games, am just very bad at them, and I cannot do it. And so I get locked out of those experiences, and I normally don't feel too bad about it. But I truly loved how this game put me in a place, especially with that, like, Guardian Ape fight that I mentioned, where I just thought, I am cornered. I cannot go anywhere until I solve this problem. And that meant trying over and over and over, and, like, redeveloping my strategy on how I wanted to play the game. And it was the first time that it really, like, forced me to become a deflection or a parry master before continuing forward. And I really respected it for that, because even in all of the previous From Software games, there's normally an alternative approach or a different way you can solve a problem that is maybe not as efficient, but close enough in efficiency to what is the most optimal strategy. And Sekiro is the first game I ever thought, like, you're going to do it this way or you're going to die, more than likely. And I liked being pushed to achieve the pinnacle of my gaming prowess in a game for the first time. It felt so good to succeed after toiling against a game that never felt unfair, unless the camera got you cornered against that centipede fight, which is maybe about halfway in the game. There's one character that was, or one boss that was fun to fight, but the camera was truly a nightmare. It's my single criticism for the game, is that they've never developed these to, like, work really well when you're being pushed around in tight spaces. But they also refrain from doing that really more than once. So it's a minor complaint in that case.
I wonder if some of it has to do... So I think our opinions differ here, because I feel like this was the easiest... This has been the easiest From Software experience from start to finish for me. And by that, I mean that, yeah, maybe I have easier ways of playing the other games now, but Sekiro, from the initial playthrough to the end of that initial playthrough... Granted, I didn't really look at guides for any of these games to begin with, at least. But that sequence of time, it was the easiest route for me to from start to finish. But at the same time, maybe like initial difficulty isn't necessarily what I always... what am I saying? I absolutely know. Difficulty itself is not what I always want out of a game. And so like while there were a few fights that were just like, what the fuck? Like, how do I take this on? The majority of the game feels like you're accomplishing things at a steadier pace compared to some of the bosses at Bloodborne, where I just had to keep fighting it repeatedly to finally get the breakthrough on. There's something about the accessibility of Sekiro that, like, despite me really liking things in Dark Souls and Bloodborne about like these completely different build paths and so forth, this game kind of prevents itself in a way that if you were playing... I'm jumping generations here, but you go and play Ninja Gaiden or you go and play Mario, there's one way to play that game, really, or from the stance of like you are who you play as. There's not this wide stretching branch of paths, and maybe that's why the game feels like it's so well tuned and oiled and acceptable the way it is. It's like I maybe would have felt this way about Dark Souls 1 or 2 if you were a generic, or not just a generic soldier, but a very specific type of person that was crafted and put into place, and the game was built around that one character. Granted, that's a completely different game, and that's what Sekiro kind of is, right? You are this shinobi, this swordsman. And I think that's maybe one of the biggest reasons why this game got so high on my list compared to other From Software games, Bloodborne being the exception. I love that game so much. Yeah. But Bloodborne's similar. Like,
Bloodborne actually does put you into a little bit more of a niche than Dark Souls ever did.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's the acknowledgement that if you want to speedrun the game, you play as like a caster in the original, like, Dark Souls games, or you essentially build like a really exploitative niche damage type. Otherwise, there's 40 different ways to build a character and approach it, and each one is going to have a different sticking point, or there's going to be just an area that is not designed with any sort of approach for your character in mind. So you just really, you have to make it work, or you have to kind of flexibly adapt around it. Bloodborne is always forcing you into being an aggro, high damage dealing hunter. There is no big defensive build that you can really move for. And the ways that you apply damage through the trick weapons is really melee bludgeoning, melee like slashing or thrusting, and then you have your blood tinge and some weird arcana abilities that I've seen maxed out, but they're rare, they're not as varied, and You really have to know what you're doing to make that work. Sekiro, it's like, you have a sword. You will block with this sword and you will swing this sword. And that is how you will solve all of your problems in combat for the most part. And maybe that is what makes it so satisfying, is the combat will always be designed with your primary kit in mind, because everybody's using the same primary kit.
In a way, Sekiro feels more like Zelda to me. Not necessarily more like Zelda than other From Software games, but it's kind of Zelda in the fashion that you have your primary tool, your sword, and then you get a pretty
gadgets.
Wide set of, yeah, exactly, of these other items that can potentially turn out to be weaknesses or like very useful against certain enemies. Like, for instance, you bring up the... whatever the hell the giant ape is. I don't recall the specific
guardian
name.
Ape. Yeah, the guardian ape.
The guardian ape becomes
my
more manageable
enemy.
with specific tools or hand tools or whatever you want to call them.
Shinobi prosthetic.
Thank you. Yes. See, it's been too long since I've played this game.
You got to play it again.
I mean, I have toyed around the idea of doing a fresh playthrough of Sekiro on stream, but it's also like it's tough for me to do those types of playthroughs again especially on stream, because like there are people that just specialize and play that game repeatedly on Twitch and or whatever streaming service. And I don't necessarily
don't want to show them up.
I mean, well, yes, of course. No, I don't necessarily think I would have anything to offer outside of being like a very passive defensive type of player in that game, which mm-hmm. is absolutely not optimal, but the game allows you to do it. It totally feels like Zelda in like a weird way, even down to the exploration. If we're going back to like Zelda 1 or Breath of the Wild, there's just so much about that game that I think is so beautifully designed, straight from the aesthetics in the environments to the high contrast, because you have all this grittiness and all this blood-soaked aesthetics in some of these buildings. And then immediately after leaving that building, you can look out and see the Japanese landscape that is almost mythical in its design. Kind of looks like
in some areas it absolutely is.
It's so great, because like I quite frankly don't think the game is necessarily from a sheer level of brilliance and beauty really that great, but it uses contrast in such an amazing way. Like you were walking around these grimy ass tunnels filled with corpses and like mummified corpses in one case, and as soon as you leave you haven't seen him before, but you leave and you're presented with like old Shinto, like red painted like temples and shrines.
Yeah.
With like a beautiful backdrop in the sky. I mean, again, comparatively speaking.
But no, yeah, what you're saying, like these grimy blue gray tunnels that you're in, and you're just getting like these small slivers of like say yellow or like orangish light from torchlight, and I think I know exactly what you're using to describe it. When you exit and you're in the like golden warm aura that is Senpu Temple, or that temple area, there's just these bright golds and greens, and there's reds, and then there's serene like white blue in the background of the mountains. It is a beautiful palette. Like it is one of the games that made me this year think like I would like to get I want to get a console with a little bit better graphical quality to it, because I think this could be something that I just like to pan the camera around in for a while and look at, because it's so pretty.
And to top it all off, I feel like the story was, yes, maybe not as complex as Bloodborne and Dark Souls, but by making it simpler, I would say so as well. As much as I like, I mean, if just very quickly talking about Dark Souls, it occurred to me that I don't actually like Dark Souls' story. I like Dark Souls' DLC's story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love the whole, I mean, really the biggest highlight of that game comes in the DLC when you find out that Artorias didn't do shit, and it was actually your character through time travel that does everything. Like, that's the highlight for me, and that's not even part of the main game.
Right.
But Sekiro, like, obviously the story gives you a lot of room for speculation, but it plays out a lot more like, I was telling Tiffany in regards to Dark Souls, we were watching one of her favorite YouTubers playing the original Dark Souls, but like, mm-hmm. From Software's lore often feels like you're being told it, or it, not actually being told, but from a sense of what you know about the details, it kind of feels like you are being told stories of like a culture's mythology, and you're discovering things little bit by little, but you never really have the full details to feel like you're actually a character within the lore, so to speak. You're not actually experiencing it firsthand. It's like you're getting the remnants of it. And Sekiro, I think, does a good job of actually putting you further into the story, but still leaving you with the mystique of, I feel like I'm in a Japanese folklore or a Japanese mythological story. And I think it does it in such a way that you have a lot of things still up in the air, because obviously your character wasn't alive during some of these points in time. But you still are invested enough in that you are actually a character, a participant of the story, as opposed to just some dude that happens to be stumbling into memories like you do in Dark Souls and Bloodborne until the very ending, when it seems like people are actually interacting with you directly for the first time in some cases. This absolutely feels like you are a major player and factor that is causing change and consequence to the land and its characters. And yes, it's not like the greatest narrative ever written, and I'm not going to say that this is by any stretch of the imagination a great story, but it's a good functional story that I think is absolutely like the bow tie around beautiful gameplay, beautiful aesthetics. I don't really remember the music much, but I think that does its service. Yeah.
It fits with the setting well enough. It's not jarring in any way, but I think the music will have less longevity on its own than previous From Software games.
It's like hearing you talk about it and hearing myself talk about it, I'm realizing now like why this is at my number two spot, and why I think it absolutely deserves to be Game of the Year at a lot of these like award shows and so forth. It's a complete package, and like while it might not be the greatest game of all time or anything close to that, it's hard to argue that there was a game that did anything or everything as well as Sekiro did across the board.
Yeah, it shows so few weaknesses. I have yet to really pinpoint on any that I've found, except for the fact, perhaps, that even someone who's seasoned with a From Software game as much as I am, there are mechanics that are sometimes just completely like missed or opaque to the casual player, or even someone who just doesn't understand that item description very well. Because I think we went into detail once discussing the game. I didn't understand that the powder was essentially like a momentary stun or whatever. And so I spent the entire game playing without this ability that I think I would have used a lot had I known it. But I just hadn't experimented with it, or I thought I had used it correctly in a different way, and thought, well, this outcome's not really that useful. So I stopped. The opacity, the opaqueness of some of the gameplay mechanics are still characteristic of From Software games, where it's like, this is not user-friendly enough yet for first-time players.
That is true. Yeah, that's very true.
So much better than previously, so it is a step in the right direction for them.
If they had like a better tutorial, this could be a game I would recommend to basically anyone, because I don't think once you figure out how to play it, like how to really play it, I don't think this game is inaccessible by any stretch of the imagination.
Agreed. Sorry we took up so much time on that when we have a couple more to round out on your list.
Yeah, so Sekiro was my second favorite game of 2019. My third favorite, and granted, I don't know if I would have still kept this in had I not had the extra time to play further into it. I'm still not complete with Death Stranding. So this goes to say that maybe the ending of Death Stranding is going to even push this higher in my list. But I don't necessarily think so, because there are obviously... I obviously just got done saying that Sekiro does such a great job with everything about the game that I don't necessarily think Death Stranding, my number three, necessarily matches that level. But and granted, I've talked about it to some extent, and I can't necessarily say too much without potentially spoiling people. But what I found with Death Stranding was not necessarily the most exciting video game of all time, but a game that allowed me to take on to really give myself what I needed at that point in time, in the day or in the week or whenever. If I wanted it to be calm and relaxing, I could play it in a more calm and relaxing setting. If I was feeling ballsy and I wanted something to like provide me with thrills, this game allowed me to do that by choosing riskier plays or riskier jobs and tasks. the most important part about Death Stranding to me, though, is also just about the thematic message it was sending. And that is one of reconnecting and building relationships, I guess, is probably like the most specific I can be without necessarily hitting the exact note I want. But relationships between humans, communication between humans, establishing connections is, I think, probably a line that had been used in the game. And the gameplay itself allows me, like, it feels like it's a suitable connection to what the theming of the game is. It's not a game about combat, at least not all the time and not as much early on. It's a game about establishing, I guess, what makes humans into humans in a post-apocalyptic world. And when at times I struggle to deal with like the moral choices of characters and their actions within video games, like Katana Zero, for instance, it's always fun to find a story and a game that lets me play the way I would want to play in an idealized world, or the like, by taking the actions I would want to within this sort of, or not an idealized world, but like the idealized actions that exist within a non-idealistic world. It's strange because in such a bleak setting, this game is actually so optimistic, at least thus far, that I find it to be just like a tale and a game worth playing. As we mentioned, Sekiro is definitely my number two, but the most controversial thing here and throughout this entire podcast, I imagine, is that I absolutely feel that the Somnium Files is my bar none favorite game of 2019.
Completely a controversy. Not that it's a bad game, but the fact that it is at the very top of the list, head and shoulders above all the other games, like, that surprises me. Or I should say, it would surprise me if it was on anyone else's list. I have not completed the game. That is the one problem I have with like leveling any sort of criticism. But I guess I don't care how well they wrap it up. It is a visual novel game, right? Almost to the point where when they deviate away from visual novel by even like animating
it's
small
so
things,
bad.
It's really bad. Yeah.
There are these cutscenes where essentially, not even like some that actually require active gameplay, because there are some of those. I don't know if you've come across them, but there are some scenes where like characters do action-y things and the animation is just god awful, and it's kooky, and
it feels like they're slightly off. Like they're not complete. They're not close enough to actually touch the thing they're trying to touch, or that their gravity is maybe 75% what it should be. It's just all over the place, a mess. And it makes it like charming and endearing for the game, but I do consider them flaws.
It absolutely feels like it's got to be intentional, because I've seen the same team do animations that don't necessarily feel as silly and wacky. Mm-hmm. And it's even worse. Or maybe not necessarily the same team. I don't know if the team from Zero Time Dilemma and Ida Somnium Files are the exact same. But like, so they tried to be more serious in past games, assuming there are related developers on these projects outside of like the creative team. Right. And it doesn't work out that well. So when I was playing like obviously this relies on past game experience, but it's like I watch these cutscenes and I'm like, yeah, they're obviously trying to go campy and wacky with this. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily like achieve what it's going for either. But to me, the experience of Eye of the Somnium File is sometimes about contrast. And like, without getting into spoilers, because obviously the story, which is absolutely the thing that cements this game into my favorite, like my absolute favorite experience of 2019, and as far as video games go, is entirely based upon spoilers.
Okay. But Scott, you can spoil if you want to. I mean, I'm enjoying the story, but it's not like getting the spoilers in this format is going to make them less enjoyable to see.
Well, so that's the interesting thing about Eye of the Somnium Files. I mean, Scott, I'm first going to ask you, have you hit like a game over yet?
Nah, man, I'm a good detective.
Okay. Okay. So you haven't hit like any roadblocks or anything?
I have not hit a dead end yet, though I think where I'm at currently, I feel like I'm very close to a dead end if there isn't some sort of breakthrough.
You're investigating, like the last time I talked to you, you said you were investigating a polar bear killer, which I know exactly what path you're on because you said that.
Yeah.
There is going to come a time where like you won't necessarily be able to proceed. So like what do you think you're going to have to do at that point?
Well, it seems like no matter what happens, I know that I will have Mizuki beat the shit out of whoever I suspect. because like you said, this game is just goofy and wacky, and that's where Sierra and I are getting all of the enjoyment out of it. The transitional, like the little interstitial scene where you're in your car moving from one location to another, you have the loading screen of just the car going by. I've been improvising the Doppler effect every time. I just go, nyerm, or I do some deviation of that. Like, I'm doing stuff to keep myself entertained and engaged on this game. But there is some sort of comfort to the the callback jokes that they really throw into this game as you progress deeper into these investigative like channels. Right now, for instance, learning more about Mizuki as a character and how she's somehow like a super weapon is fascinating and made me, I mean, it delighted me that your character or the character of Date is always repeating, remember rule number one, never strike your master. And he's doing the super tropey, like very good, like Chinese martial arts master, like voiceover for it, which is very funny too.
Yeah, he's basically doing the stereotypical Mr. or Master Miyagi.
Yeah, Master Miyagi
there,
or whoever the guy is from, like. That old ancient like martial arts master. It's the same kind of trope that Uma Thurman's teacher in Kill Bill like has as well. Where they're like, oh, go ahead.
Oh, but I'm sorry. You finish your thought because I'm gonna derail it.
No, I think honestly we do need to just deviate away from it. I had too much fun with the temple scene, is what I'm saying. And the weird like. The game also has maybe caused me to waste more time than actually pursuing the story because there are 40 items you can look at and it's like a lamp and you look at it, it goes, it's just a lamp, desk, it's just a desk. And then it's like Chiozu, which is essentially a hand and face washing station for when you go to pray. And you get this dialogue that's like, that's a Chiozu. What do you do there? You have to wash out your belly button before you go to pray. And you'll come back to it later. And it's just like, do you think that Mizuki still thinks you're supposed to wash out your belly button? Like, I burn a lot of time looking around the environment, knowing that 80% of the stuff I investigate is useless and I shouldn't waste my time on it. But the jokes are so good in the few areas that they're like tucked away and hidden that it's worth it every time.
Did you look at the receptionist and continue to look at the receptionist?
I just won't. I mean, I didn't do it like over and over. We're talking about the receptionist who is, she's very well endowed and the game has a creepy focus upon it.
Let's be clear. It's not the game that has a creepy
Date.
Focus on it.
Yeah, no,
Date
that's true.
Has a creepy focus on and the receptionist's massive chest. And the receptionist is definitely showing off the chest, wearing clothing that would showcase physical trait.
She has no doubts about who she is. But I haven't, like, say in that context, I haven't actually gone down any of the conversational routes that I think are creepy, but I feel like maybe I should, because Date already pulls shit that, like, obviously I wouldn't do. I'm not, I'm more of an observer for Date with this game, right, than I am controlling his actions.
Yes.
Because there are times where Date's like, I want to punch this guy's lights out. And I'm like, that's a terrible idea. And someone else has to step in. And they're like, whoa, you need to calm down, buddy. You can't just punch somebody's lights out. And I was like, that's what I've been saying. Listen to me.
That's part of the fun is exploring. Like, it sounds like you have maybe gone through 20% of the game, if not like a little less.
It seems like I've gone through so much more, though. I am surprised at how little I've done. So, if you're telling me this.
This is not a spoiler because it's a thought I had while playing the game. Part of me was really like, I don't necessarily think I'm playing as Date. I think I'm playing as Aiba. There's only one character that you physically move around in that game and do things with. And that's Aiba.
And that you can mostly agree with as a character.
She's absolutely the same functional one of the pair. Aiba mm-hmm. is this artificial intelligence that resides within Date's artificial eye. The name Eye the Somnium Files is definitely meant
to... It's a super layered metaphor, yeah.
Yes. For one thing, like they have you pronounce it as I as opposed to Aiba, because you can refer to it I without the spelling in multiple ways, as the eyeball, the organ in your body that sees, you know, that essentially is your visual interpretation. I as in myself, I as in artificial intelligence, obviously. There's so many different ways you're supposed to take what I stand for and the association of Aiba, this essentially the main character, second main character to the game. But more importantly, the entire reason why we went down this whole rabbit hole of like the massive amounts of content that are buried away within like the point and click adventure style aspect of the game is that at some point I found myself playing this game initially with the scope of what is the mystery and twist going to be? What is actually going on here? And yes, that's like, that has its rewarding payoff, but unlike the other games where it literally had to shove it into my face at the very end, the big reveal comes, you pull off the tarp from the giant answer or plot twist or Deus Ex Machina in one case. Which is the most satisfying part of the game. This game wasn't that. I started to like get a good grasp of the situation maybe 60% of the way through the game. And part of that, it took maybe a little longer, like 75%. And it only took that much longer because I had been trained through this director's other games that there's a lot of bait and switching that... happens, and there's a lot of red herrings, so you can never trust anything. But when I talked to my friend Daniel, who this is his first Uchikoshi game, he basically was like, yeah, I think I figured it out maybe halfway through the game. Like, I had most of it down, and it could also depend on the paths that he took first.
Mm-hmm.
But what really stood out to me in Eye of the Somnium Files that I don't think has happened to me in quite a while was finding out, like, partway through the game, starting to realize that like the actual quality of this game is the degree of affection and emotions I'm feeling for all of these different characters.
It's except it, like, Dota.
Borderline better than any anime I've watched. We're usually like an anime, unless you're watching Monster or Another or basically any of the drama / crime animes, animes are all about making you invested in characters' lives and wanting you, the audience, to care about these characters and want them to succeed or do whatever. Mm-hmm. Even battle animes are absolutely all about, like, yes, there's the instant gratification of winning battles and so forth, but it's really
about...
But you
have to want the character to win the battle. Yeah.
And you want the character to grow and succeed. Like, What is the biggest part of Naruto, like the ending of Naruto? It's essentially the realization that like this kid who was a reject, like people literally hated him for being born because of the circumstances of his birth, becoming the chief and having that direct comparison of young Naruto to like the beloved character and hero that he has now become. It's not about him winning a big war at the end and game over, the battle between him and Sasuke is over, The battle itself isn't what matters. It's about their friendship. And I, the Somnium Files, like, it definitely felt like it caught me off guard because I didn't expect good character writing and good characters. And it, like, you don't expect that in games that take place over short periods of time, because you can't have believable growth usually over that period of time. Now, granted, this game does take place over a longer period than most of Uchikoshi's works, but I certainly wasn't expecting to become that invested in Mizuki and Ota. Like, these characters that I honestly felt were like scumbags. Like, God, I started off hating Ota.
I mean, I'm still there.
Like, I hated Ota so much, especially because, so in your playthrough, kind of getting into some spoilers here, Ota's fucking dead, right?
No.
No, what? Really?
What? I guess, okay, that's a testament to why this game is good. No, he's totally fine. I mean, he's not fine, but he's not dead either.
Okay, okay. I see, when you were talking about the polar bear, I assumed I knew exactly what route. But now I know which route you're down. You could be on two routes.
One where Ota is dead and one where he is not.
No, both where he's alive.
He's definitely alive, though.
So the interesting... But so you found Ota on the floor of a warehouse, right?
Yeah, I did.
And now you're starting to question yourself, like, is this all a fucking ruse? I don't... Wait, no, is it? I'm trying to remember exactly what your route is. Your route, if I'm not mistaken, is one where, like, yeah, you don't necessarily know what to think of that crime scene and situation.
I mean, if we want to be fair here, this is a game that has caused me to question, like, my concept of reality existing even within the game, where it's like, can it be a curse moving from like one person to the next? Because the first like three crime scenes you go to, it's like, ah, yes, the person who I thought would have been the primary suspect for the last murder has now been murdered or attempted to be murdered. so I guess they're off the hook. Like, I just don't know. I can say I have no fucking clue. But I think I'm willing to bet that it is actually a real sentient polar bear, and it's a red herring for me to think that it's a polar bear costume. This polar bear has a vendetta against these folks for increasing and worsening the effects of climate change with this chemical plant like going under with its big spill.
I mean, it was such a great experience for me, and part of it, so I thought I remembered exactly how I played the game, and like I was mapping it out with Daniel, my friend who had just played too, and trying to figure out where we changed and differed. And then it occurred to me that like I wasn't actually being extremely forthcoming with the routes I took, because at points in time, I started to doubt whether or not I chose the right path. Because there's got to be a right path, right? Right?
No, like, I mean,
there needs to be an outcome where everyone lives, just like in Three Houses. There's an outcome where you save all the houses, right? Doesn't that happen? No, it doesn't.
Well, no, because the mom's always dead, so you can't save everybody.
Right, but so I was still...
I mean,
like,
if we start a game where one character is immutably dead, I can't change that, it does make it a lot easier to let other characters die. It's just my perfect score is fucked. Like, we might as well just try and get to the end here.
That is true, but, you know, sometimes, like, you're an investigator. You play as a detective in this game, and because I'm so inquisitive, if there's something that I don't necessarily understand as I'm going down one path, I start to think to myself, maybe I should jump over in that path over there where the grass is greener. Maybe I should go down the path where Mizuki is actually able to talk. That seems like a good idea. Instead of being
fucking
traumatized.
You messed up.
Well, no, I mean, so that's the thing. Or maybe I go down that path and I'm like, a lot of people are fucking dying down this path. Maybe I should go down the path where Mizuki's a mute still. She'll be fine, right? Huh. She's still traumatized from seeing her mom's dead body. But that, like, because I was jumping around, it also gave me a lot of time to interact with these characters and also see different sides of them. And, like, what resulted in, and I'm saying this because I'm qualifying. I don't necessarily know if everyone's going to get the same experience I did.
I can say that you talking about it has already made me appreciate it more. Just like, well, even getting to discuss the game has really brought out, like, it's reminded me of the things that I do like about it.
And so that's like the crazy thing, is that all of these other games I played of Uchikoshi's were about the mystery, and that was the most important thing. But this game, it doesn't matter as much. Mm-hmm. It is such... It's crazy saying this. It's obviously the thing that ties everything together, but the most important thing that the mystery does is the fact that it exists and allows a story to be told about characters.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, what I, the Somnium File, does, that these files, rather, does, that the other games don't necessarily, and no other game I can think of over the last couple years necessarily, was the degree of care and affection and enjoyment I got out of the characters and learning about them and finding out their motivations. I finished I, the Somnium Files and realized that, like, of the characters I hated from, like, a personal level of, like, this is what the things they did and yada yada, it occurred to me that there was only one, arguably two, depending on the day, out of the entire cast that I could actually say, God, I fucking hate that guy, or God, I hate that woman. And you know what? I was surprised.
That's the path that you went down, the one that kept them dead.
I was surprised to realize who the characters that I started to appreciate and understand, and think to myself, like, yeah, you know what? That guy seemed like a giant asshole, or that Ota seemed like a scumbag,
yeah,
like a freaking creep. But you know what? Now, considering all these different things, like, he's maybe not as bad. Or that dude, that evil dude, like, man, what a scumbag. But you know what? Everything he did is actually completely justified now, minus, like, maybe he could have done a few things differently. But maybe, like, maybe I would have done the same things if I were in his shoes.
Dressed up in a polar bear costume.
Who do you think did it, by the way?
Oh, I have no idea. I honestly, I could not tell you. If I were to take, like... I'm assuming that it's impossible for Date to be responsible for the murders. But if there's anyone I want to see be responsible for the murders, it's Date.
What was the last dream you've done?
What is the last dream I've done? Last dream I did was the warehouse dream with Ota on the floor. My biggest roadblock on getting further in this game is Sierra has, like, she experienced maybe the first dream, like, maybe 5 to 10% of what I was doing, and was like, this game looks dumb. And then the second dream happened, and she's like, huh, okay. And then by the third dream, she's like, I don't want you playing this game if I'm not around.
Yeah, the first dream is absolutely a stupid tutorial one.
It's such a, yeah. Oh, and I guess I'm skipping that one. I guess because that dream is a different first dream than the demo first dream.
Right.
So that's maybe the confusion. But this is such a good game for spectating, for, like, watching or playing with a friend or partner or somebody experiencing it with you. Like, because the interaction, the story is at least that engaging. I just cannot say good yet. I'm not comfortable saying good, but I will say engaging for sure.
So the dream you did after the demo one, so to speak, you did Mizuki's. You restored Mizuki's.
You have Mizuki's dream. The second dream I did for that was Aset
and
or Iris.
And what was the outcome of that? This very outgoing, cheerful girl. This.
And
internet
her creepy
idol.
Fucking slaughter warehouse dream.
Oh, and what was the last thing you saw in that dream?
I think I shot some. Oh my God. Yeah. I found a senator up to no good.
Started making trouble in my name. Wait. Really? That was the last thing you saw in that dream?
I saw a blue figure getting intimate with a senator.
didn't you see glass on the floor?
Maybe. I don't remember that. I don't. That doesn't ring a bell.
All right, you know
what? More interested
Let's
in the
end
senator.
This episode. I want to find the clip because I'm pretty sure it's the dream you saw, and I just want to show it to you to like invigorate your mystique.
Yeah, revitalize my. Okay.
So
sounds good.
In summary, like obviously, granted, I don't always like value mechanics at the top of my cup of tea, but what I do like a lot is like shock value, story, and intrigue and mystery. Like I love mystery, and that's why I have Insomnium Files, along with like the stellar cast. And the voice acting I fucking love. Actually, Greg Shun is amazing as Date.
I did note. I think Sierra and I at the same time at one point were just like, wow, this voice acting is like head and shoulders above what we were expecting. Like it really surprised and impressed me. And it's one of the few games where just having the like auto function going on where it auto plays the dialogue for most of it. Like it is I think the better way to play the game. I really like it. I'll just fold laundry during like a long
dialogue
portion
scene.
Of dialogue. Yeah, wow, I can't speak. I'm too busy folding laundry right now. but yeah, like a long scene of dialogue. Shoot, I'll just like, I'll chill. I'll make a cup of tea while I like listen to what's going on. There's also something almost like watching a show in some of these elements as well, which I think works to the strengths of it being a visual novel. It's more fun than reading dead unvoiced text for like line after line after line.
Yeah,
I also remember the information much better, and I do really like the puzzle solving to it as well, like how you formulate ideas, and there's almost like a different mini game for certain portions of solving a crime scene or the crime, which is cool too.
Man, I feel like maybe I should just stream this. Like I would love to play AI the Somnium File again. Somnium Files again. Just to like experience it after knowing everything now. The music is also just, this is my last note, then end of the podcast.
Good.
The music, it's crazy because I did not realize how good the music was as I was playing the game, which I think is a testament to like the soundtrack. It's not necessarily, you know, Persona 5 flamboyant, out there, amazing, whatever. But it was so,
it's perfect background.
Yeah, it was so good for the moment when I'm playing the game. There were a couple tracks that obviously jumped out to me. But in particular, it never drew my attention away from the voice acting and the story. And only was it after, like, we maybe talked about AI to some extent, did I actually look up the music, the soundtrack, and start listening and realizing some of these tracks are bangers. Like, I can listen to it and work with it, which I think is kind of a rare thing for me to do with soundtracks to begin with. I usually find them like whatever and, you know, have to skip half of the songs. The dream sequences are like, a lot of that music is unnerving as heck. Just overall, like it basically emphasizes everything I want out of an experience and doesn't necessarily emphasize the things I don't care as much about. And while I would love like a good playing video game on top of it, I don't think it's required. If I played a Zelda game that was a visual novel game, I would be probably annoyed because being Zelda, I mean, that'd be cool too, but being Link is about the adventure and the sword swinging, the swashbuckling and so forth. But yeah, what am I going to do? Walk around an office in this game? And that, I think, obviously tells you why I love this game and why it's one of my favorite games. My favorite game of 2019. And that is it for Fancy Ramen Podcast Episode 147, PAX South 2020 and Games of the Year 2019. If you disagree or have your own list you'd like to submit, you can write into podcast@fancyramen.com.
Don't be afraid to tune in to the Fancy Ramen Podcast on Sunday starting at noon at twitch.tv/cookiesmilk, CUKISKMILK. And I believe Fancy Ramen TV is also hosting us. Possibly. Maybe. Who knows?
I am.
Oh, nice. So you can catch us at either one of these stations And don't be afraid to watch our backup crew and twitch.tv at jfrayallday, our rt_strong_man.
Please tell friends and family about our podcast. That is the best way to spread the word. We don't care where they find us. We just appreciate that they listen.
I'm Cookie.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Neil. Have a great week, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Bye.